It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The global tattoo market, the research report was published over the summer. It looks at market size, industry trends, demographics, and analysts predict strong growth for the foreseeable future, in part driven by technology innovation and an evolving tattoo culture that is more diverse and inclusive. Join in on body art, healing from trauma, eliminating stereotypes about tattoos, 800-642-1234. Caitlin Romanesco is here and is a tattooist and medical esthetician at Plastic Surgery and Skin Specialist by Bay Care Clinic in Green Bay. Caitlin, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Alexandra Winthrop as well, tattoo artist at Evergreen Studios in Chicago. Work includes scar cover-up tattooing. Alexandra, welcome to you from the Windy City.
Thank you. Good morning. It's great being here.
Well, Alexandra, let's start with you. You do tattoos to cover up scars. What range of experiences do people have before coming to you?
I work primarily, it's a good mix of folks coming in with self-harm scars and surgery scars. So a lot of folks either looking to heal from really dark times or just, you know, get over a traumatic portion of their lives, just looking for a non-judgmental person to help them through that journey.
I would imagine, too, that people of all ages from all walks of life are, coming to you. How do you develop rapport with a stranger as they sit down with you and open up about a deeply personal experience about a scar, or also sharing a personal experience of getting a tattoo?
Oh, my. It's definitely tricky with that. It helps. I've been doing this for almost 10 years now. Building up that rapport is kind of coming second nature now. It also helps that I myself am someone who have sought out a scar cover up in the past. So being able to have that empathy for folks coming in and knowing the stigma that folks feel in having to hide those scars and looking for that place of healing, is helpful in that experience.
Mm-hmm. Caitlin, let's turn to you because you work out of a clinic setting, a medical clinic in Green Bay. How does your work differ from decorative tattooing?
So it honestly doesn't really differ too much as far as clinical versus tattoo shop specifically. Mm-hmm. We're still tattooing. The only difference would be that I work kind of hand in hand with our surgeons here, especially with the type of tattooing that I do with mastectomy or breast cancer survivors. They go hand in hand. So I am able to kind of consult and have these discussions with these patients before we even go in and kind of figure out the tattoo part.
How successful are you in able to use that form of tattooing after a mastectomy?
Yeah, so very successful. Every patient has a different journey, right? Their healing journey has started, maybe a year, maybe 2 years ago, sometimes even longer than that. I like to kind of consider myself that finishing piece, if you will, or like kind of that last topper to the cake, if you will, kind of give them that sense of being whole again. Some of them feel like they've lost part of who they are as a woman, and I'm able to kind of come in and give them a little bit of that back.
We're talking about tattooing that addresses issues of trauma and body image. Caitlin Romanesco, their medical esthetician and tattooist in Green Bay. Alexandra Winthrop with us, Chicago tattoo artist. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Alexandra, deeply personal, I'm sure, but can you talk a little bit about your perspective of SCAR cover-up and what you have gone through?
Well, they're very much with any kind of scars. There is that stigmatization of, I mean, obviously it's been folks who are looking for a cover-up for that have those scars because, especially self-harm-wise, because they have been through a dark time. And as with many things, visually-wise, anything that's perceived as different is going to get a lot of judgment. So for myself or for the clients with whom I work with, there is that sense of looking to regain that confidence, feeling at home in one's own body again. Definitely that biggest portion of the healing journey. And to an extent, there is a lot less stigmatization with extensive or beautiful tattooing than there is with visual scars. The folks getting those scar cover-ups, they're always going to know that those scars are there. But being able to, visually replace them with something beautiful, something that's of one's own choice, is so important, because whether it's self-harm scars or surgical scars, receiving those scars isn't necessarily one's choice. So being able to take that power back and be able to make that choice that I'm going to make this into something beautiful, it's, so important with any scar cover-up.
Thank you for sharing that. Let's go to Karen in Green Bay. Karen, what's your story?
My story is I had breast cancer, and I lost, of course, my hair and my eyelashes and my eyebrows. And, I'd look in the mirror after I had cancer, and I'd think, who is that? I was like a ghost. So anyway, I decided, since my eyebrows never came back, I decided to treat myself to microblading. And it was a miracle. I had that done. It just helped me so much as far as my self-esteem. I just felt more beautiful. I'd get up in the morning and I'd look in the mirror and like, oh my gosh, I'm back again. But anyway, so it was just such a gift to me, to be able to have that done. And that's all I wanted to say.
Oh, Karen, thank you so much. Caitlin, what do you make of that? A gift to see yourself whole again, or how you would like to see yourself?
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly that. It's truly a gift. It's such a privilege, and it's super rewarding, especially in the field, that Alexandria and I are in, to kind of give that back to someone, especially when they've gone through so much, whether it be, self-harm, cancer, surgery, whatever their journey is. It's so awesome to give that to them, where they're looking at themselves in the mirror and they feel beautiful and they feel whole. There's really no other feeling that's really more rewarding than that.
And can you explain a little bit, because you are trained in 3D tattooing and this form of medical tattooing. Can you explain a little bit there? Yes.
So really the main difference with that is, with Alexandria, she's, doing more of the big pieces, which, I looked at some of her work earlier, and by the way, it's amazing. I specialize more in actually just creating what looks like a normal areola with a nipple. Mm-hmm. And that can be either we're starting from scratch, we're creating two new ones for a patient, or sometimes they already have one and we're going to have to create the other one to kind of match that one. And sometimes too, they have lightening of the areola and we have to go in and kind of touch that up or, make it darker. It's all kind of case by case, if you will. But more of it is just on the realism aspect for people that aren't necessarily ready to kind of go and create like a big, bold piece. They don't really, that's not what they're going for. That's kind of where I come in.
We're exploring the power of tattoos with Caitlin Romanesco, medical esthetician, tattooist in Green Bay, and Chicago-based tattoo artist Alexandra Winthrop on Scar Cover-Up. Join in on expressing through tattoos how you've seen the cultural significance. Maybe you've had a scar cover-up. 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Tattoos, piercings, they've skyrocketed in popularity over the last few decades. And according to a recent piece in SciPost reporting on psychology and neuroscience, trauma survivors may turn to body modification like tattoos as a way to overcome past experiences. Join in on tattooing as a healing art on Scar Cover-Up, 800-642-1234. Tattoo artists Alexandra Winthrop and Caitlin Romanesco stay with us. We heard from Sheila in Madison, called in and couldn't stay with us. And Sheila wants to know, Alexandra, when tattooing over scars, does the body absorb or spread the ink differently?
It depends on the type of scar tissue. So the main types of scar tissue out there, there's the more shallow scars. There's thicker, deeper scars. You can have hypertrophic scarring or keloid scarring. All of them act very differently in regards to how you tattoo them, how it heals. Most often with any sort of thicker scars, you may need a second pass over the scar tissue to ensure that everything is just as saturated as it is on the rest of the skin. High detail may not be possible with some thicker scars. So depending on the type of scar, I may elect to, do more of a texture-based design to conceal them versus like something super, super detailed. Or, there's definitely many ways of doing that. I always do a very in-depth consultation with folks before we get into the design to get an idea of the type of scarring that they have and what exactly design-wise would work best for their particular scar situation.
That makes sense. Caitlin, Sheila also was wondering that red ink on tattoos, that it used to be problematic with MRIs, and is wondering, is that still the case?
I have personally not experienced that. I think pigments have come a long way since then. The pigments that I use are specifically created for tattooing areolas. It is actually an areola pigment set. I wouldn't necessarily say we even use a red. I use more of pinks and neutrals versus a solid red color.
Okay. Thank you, Sheila, for those questions. Let's bring in Susan now in Madison. Susan, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Well, I just have basically a comment. Actually, it's an aha moment, because I'm a cancer survivor and I, in 2017, had breast replacements with the tattooing done. And I just realized that I do have tattoos and I don't even think of them as tattoos. I think it was just part of the treatment, part of the process. And I just realized that, yeah, I have tattoos.
Susan, thank you. So, Caitlin, I would imagine you would see that as a success story.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, that's awesome. That means that, whoever did those areolas, I mean, they did a great job and she's obviously very happy with them. So I'd say that was a job well done.
How long after surgery must you wait to begin your process?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I rule of thumb 6 months at least from last surgery. There are certain circumstances where I have done it slightly sooner, only off of their doctor's request. But typically, I will not touch their skin until 6 months last surgery.
Talking with Caitlin Romanesco, medical esthetician and tattooist in Green Bay. Alexandra Winthrop is here, tattoo artist in Chicago, on scar cover-up. And your experiences, 800-642-1234. I want to turn to licensing, Alexandra. What is involved in the licensing of a tattoo artist where you are?
That's a great question. It definitely varies by state and location. In Chicago, the tattoo studio is the one that necessarily requires a license. Individual artists have to renew their yearly bloodborne pathogens training, but individuals themselves do not require a tattoo license.
Okay. And Caitlin, I understand you received training at an institute of tattooing in Pennsylvania. What was your licensing like for you and that training?
Yeah, so the licensing here in Wisconsin is actually very similar to what it is in Chicago. For tattooing specifically, a lot of that has to do with the clinic and getting those done and then renewing your bloodborne pathogens yearly as well. As far as my training, yes, I went to Soller Institute, which is in Pennsylvania. It's affiliated with Penn State, and they work out of there doing all the areola reconstruction for them. It was about a week long, full days, 10-hour days, just basically nonstop tattooing. We did have, models come in or, breast cancer patients from some of the hospitals out in Pennsylvania that we were able to kind of work on, which was super rewarding and just overall an amazing experience. If anyone's looking to kind of ever get into it, I would definitely recommend going out there, making the trip. It's definitely worth it.
Let's bring in Joy now in West Bend. Joy, hi. You're a nurse?
Yes, well, I'm a retired nurse, but I worked in inpatient psychiatry at one time, and I think about a woman who came in. She would be self-harming and, ask to come in. And I just think about her a lot because when I would try to talk with her about her, the emotional, physical, and sexual abuse she suffered as a child, the rest of our staff would say, "Well, we just want you to give medications and, talk lightly with these people. We don't want you to open this can of worms." In order to have a tattoo to cover up something like that or to help deal with that, I would think that a person has to go through a lot of therapy or a lot of work to get to a point where you're ready for a tattoo. And I'm wondering how these tattoo artists have been involved with that work that people have done. Is it done before they come, during, after?
Joy, yeah, such an important question. Alexandra, you first.
Absolutely. I mean, it's such an endeavor if you're looking to get a scar cover up, going to an absolute stranger with this amount of trauma that you've suffered and having to open up about some of that too, or at least be vulnerable enough to say, "Hey, I'm looking to get a scar cover up." Again, as someone who has gone through that myself, I understand there, some folks are going to want to delve into that a little bit during the tattoo. Some folks are not going to. And it's so important to be able to, be there for them no matter which way they're feeling. And number one, offer up that opportunity to get the scar cover up, but just be that person who, understands that you've been through something, you're looking to regain something, and I am here for that. I'm here to help you for that.
Alexandra and Caitlin, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your work.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
Alexandra Winthrop is a tattoo artist at Evergreen Studios in Chicago. Caitlin Romanesco is a medical esthetician and tattooist at Plastic Surgery and Skin Specialists by Bay Care Clinic in Green Bay. And stay with us on this topic as we hear from the owners of a tattoo studio in Madison catering to Indigenous and LGBTQ plus communities. Join in on Tattoos and Diversity in Ink, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss countries coming together to talk about climate goals at COP27, the annual United Nations climate conference underway in Egypt. Here's UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres with a message to world leaders at the opening ceremony.
We are on a highway to climate hell with our foot still on the accelerator.
Join in 800-642-1234. Samudu Atupatu is director of the Global Legal Studies Center and senior lecturer at UW Law School, teaches international environmental law with a focus on climate change and human rights. Samudu, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You attended COP26 last year in Glasgow, Scotland. How important are these gatherings of world leaders to talk about climate change?
Very important, so that everybody gets a chance to get together in one forum and discuss these issues. Of course, because of the sheer sort of size of these events, COP26 had over 25,000 attendees. It kind of has a circus atmosphere, but I think getting together to discuss these issues is very important.
I think I saw a number like 44,000 at this year's conference of number of people who had expected to attend. When it gets to that size, are there challenges with a size like that for this conference?
Oh, absolutely. It's very difficult to navigate everything that's going on, but it also gives hope, I think, to see how many people are committed to this issue, especially the younger generation. It is also very nice to see different groups represented, not just states, so indigenous peoples, women's groups, youth groups. So there's an energy that is very nice to see. Of course, there are challenges with such large numbers, but, you know, I think it's really nice to see how many people are actually committed to this issue.
Are these conferences making progress? I mean, the last true breakthrough basically was the signing of the Paris Agreement in 2015. What is the next big breakthrough?
Well, I think it is important to see how much states are actually fulfilling their commitments rather than having these big sort of breakthroughs. As you see, the big breakthrough that I would like to see is actually fulfilling the commitments that states made. And from what I have been reading, we are nowhere near what we promised to do. In other words, in order to limit the temperature increase to 1.5 degrees Celsius, states need to cut their emissions by 50% by 2030. And that's not very far away. Unfortunately, we are nowhere near meeting that commitment.
When you talk about these climate commitments, I think of President Biden, who signed into law the Inflation Reduction Act over the summer. climate change a big thing in that law, over $365 billion for climate action. When you look at these commitments, could this entice or spur other nations to update their climate commitments?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the sort of excuses that other industrialized nations have been giving is that U.S. as the biggest emitter has not been doing enough. So I think this was a really good sort of spur for other countries also to get their act together. But the real problem is the impact of climate change on small island states and developing countries who contributed very little to climate change in terms of emissions, but are being disproportionately affected by the consequences, to the extent of some of them even becoming extinct due to sea level rise and severe weather events associated with climate change.
Talking about the case for climate reparations, what to do about poor countries and the impact of climate change on them. Samudu Attipattu is director of the Global Legal Study Center, senior lecturer at UW Law School. You can join in on COP27 and the Climate Summit, 800-642-1234. Chris is here from Port Wing. Chris, what would you like to bring up?
Well, I want to thank you for having this segment. I think it would be great if we could see several segments during the 2 weeks of COPs, because there's several very important issues, none the least of which is about the $121 trillion of stranded assets in carbon fuels that we have to keep in the ground. That's going to be an economic disaster. But the major problem right now appears to be a lack of maturity in the wealthy global nations with regard to funding loss and damages. This is a major topic at the COP, and we wealthy nations have not met our initial $100 million goal. We're only at about $83 million, and we're going to need to see hundreds of billions of dollars to fund the actual kind of losses and damages that we're seeing today in these less wealthy, less responsible for climate change nations. And it just seems like the wealthy global north isn't mature enough to even approach the topic.
Chris, thank you for that, addressing loss and damage. Chris Singh, a thorny topic that is coming up in these talks. Samudu, addressing the harm by poor nations despite the best mitigation and adaptation efforts. What is the role of wealthy nations?
That's a very important and thorny topic, and it is the first time, although the Paris Agreement included loss and damage in the text itself, developed countries, the global north, insisted that it does not lead to compensation, liability and compensation. So that was included in the decisions that were taken at the Paris Agreement, Paris Conference. So for the first time since the Paris Agreement was adopted, loss and damage was actually included in the official agenda at COP27. So it took us several years to even talk about this. In fact, there was an attempt at COP23 or 24 in Madrid to actually exclude it from the Paris Agreement. I don't know whether it's lack of maturity or lobbying by fossil fuel companies that's holding us back. The Global North has not really contributed to the loss and damage fund. Scotland, for the first time, because it was a host last year, promised some money into the loss and damage mechanism. So we are hoping that this year, at least, this will receive the attention it deserves. And I must mention that, if national security is at issue, money is never a problem. And climate change is a national, global security issue. So I don't really understand why we are not really putting more money into addressing climate change. And if we even divert 5% of our security budget to addressing climate change, we'll go a long way in addressing some of these consequences.
Samudu, is there a legal precedent for industrialized nations that are doing the bulk of this emitting to make reparations? What about the law?
Law, unfortunately, is lagging behind. Part of the problem is this is a global problem, which means that everybody is contributing to the problem. So everybody is a perpetrator as well as a victim at the same time. But the law actually recognizes the higher role that the global north plays in this. So there is a principle that the legal framework is based on, called the Common But Differentiated Responsibility Principle, which recognizes the disproportionate contribution that the global north has made. We have a sort of paid compensation during the first Gulf War for environmental damage. That was the first time that environmental damage was compensated. So there is some precedent for this, but the crucial question, of course, is funding. We do need funding into the loss and damage mechanism. We do need funding for small island states to adapt to the consequences. And then, of course, the big humanitarian issue is if these islands are going to disappear completely, what will happen to the people? Where will they go? So that's another big issue that the international community has to address.
What about the role of banks in this issue of loss and damage to get more private investment into developing nations? And, you know, private investment, they don't want to take on the risk in developing countries. But is there an opportunity here to incentivize international banks to figure out new protocols to opening up markets for climate, climate products and more economic vitality with that?
Absolutely. I think this is a great opportunity for every sector, whether it's banking or investment or even, you know, as you said, developing products, because there's a huge market out there that we haven't really made use of, and looking at this as an economic opportunity. And it is an economic opportunity as well as, of course, has a huge impact on the global economy if we don't address this situation. So I don't really understand why this has not been looked at as an economic opportunity to invest in cleaner technology and greener products. And as consumers, we play a huge role too, because we need to start demanding these cleaner technologies and green energy, renewable energy sources. So I think it's all hands on deck now.
Samudu Attipattu leads the UW Law School's Global Legal Study Center. As we discuss the UN Climate Change Conference underway in Egypt, the key aim, the UN says, of ensuring full implementation of the Paris Agreement. Join in, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As we discuss the UN climate talks underway in Egypt, here's former U.S. Vice President Al Gore addressing world leaders at the opening of COP27.
We have a credibility problem, all of us. We're talking and we're starting to act, but we're not doing enough. It is a choice to continue this pattern of destructive behavior.
The White House saying President Joe Biden will be at COP27 tomorrow to build on momentum to tackle the climate crisis. Join in on what these talks signal to you. 800-642-1234. We have UW Law School's Sumadu Atupatu, teaches international environmental law, stays with us. Let's bring on a call, Jack in Madison. Jack, what's on your mind about COP27?
Morning. I don't know if this is going to get much attention at COP27 because at best it's probably a recent or maybe a newer development, but I've had some speculations as to how we can reverse global warming and climate change, and I wondered if there might be any kind of forum for those kinds of ideas at COP27.
On how to actually reverse climate change, not just, so to speak, tread water.
Yes.
Sumadu, is there that type of conversation at these summits and at COP27?
I presume you are referring to geoengineering options.
Jack, is that right?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Sure. I mean, it's not on the official agenda. I doubt whether they will talk about this officially, but scientists are indeed looking at these options because states are not doing enough to reduce their emissions. But the problem with these geoengineering options is we don't really know the long-term impacts of them. I mean, there are some, there are various options that scientists are looking at, from carbon capture and storage to planting, stuff on the ocean floor, to putting mirrors in outer space and, you know, lots of different things that they're actually experimenting with. So the long-term impact is something that we should be aware of, should be worried about. The other thing is there's no legal framework right now to sort of regulate these activities. So individual scientists are doing this, not even states. On those two, for those two reasons, I'll be a little wary about this. But on the other hand, some are arguing that we have already geoengineered the Earth because the temperature has already increased by 1.1 degrees Celsius. And others argue that we may not have a choice. But I would caution people to look at the long-term impact and adopt a precautionary approach to these geoengineering options.
Jack, thank you for that call. Sumadu, you're from Sri Lanka. How are people there being affected by climate change?
As you know, Sri Lanka is an island. It's not a small island, but it's nonetheless an island. So the entire coastal belt is being affected by sea level rise, by severe weather events, and we can no longer rely on the rain patterns because we had two seasons, two monsoons, and those are no longer predictable. There have been heavy rains, very severe weather events with landslides and things like that affecting people. Agriculture is a big part of the economy that has been affected, as well as tourism. Of course, there have been other political and economic factors at play, but climate change is a big, having a big impact on the economy in terms of agriculture, tourism, fisheries, because many people are engaged in fisheries. So all those things are affected by climate change.
Sumadu Atupatu with us, director of the Global Legal Studies Center at UW Law School, as we look at COP27. Let's go to Roberta in Milwaukee. Hi, Roberta. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for this opportunity. I've been wondering how individuals really are going to be impacting this kind of significant shift we need to make. I have often, you know, heard my friends just continue to you know, travel across the globe to go to various and sundry wonderful places. And I think, you know, I don't know, what can we do as individuals? It feels like our individual behaviors need to shift as much as we expect a government or a corporation or you know, large quantities of money to shift things. Mm. What do we, I've always noticed how powerful an individual's actions or inactions can be.
Roberta, thank you on the pointing out the power of scale there from the individual to entire countries. Samudu, what about the individual in this?
Oh, absolutely. As individuals, I mentioned as consumers, we make a lot of choices and we need to get together and, you know, request big changes. But at the individual level, we can make choices too. Do we drive everywhere? You know, I take the bus to work. I don't drive. I take public transportation. Can we make that choice, for example? Can we cycle? I know, you know, weather is a factor that we need to take into account, but there are lots of little changes that we can do, which will make a big impact. You know, there are over 9 billion people, I think, in this world. If all of us make good choices, then we can, you know, make a difference. But we also need big action at the international level, at our state level. And also I read an article that billionaires are the main cause of climate change, not us as individuals. So we really need these big companies to make changes as well. But as individuals, we need to make, you know, good choices, recycling. You know, plastic bottles is a huge problem. You know, weaning away from that. You know, there are lots of things that we can do as individuals.
An all hands on deck approach. Samudu, yeah. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Samudu Attapattu is director of the Global Legal Studies Center and senior lecturer at UW Law School as we've been talking about COP27. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.